everyone, and welcome to the Shedcast Britain and the Sea, number 3, Catching a Crab. Last time, we used the story of Eustace the Monk to talk about England and the sea between 1066 and 1217. A story, part history, part folktale. This time, we'll talk about the 13th and 14th centuries and a couple of individuals, Walter le Fleming and John Crabb, who formed a new tradition, which owed as much to Eustace as to any concept of a British Royal Navy. It's a rather fascinating time, though equally a little disappointing if you're looking for a glorious tale of English or British naval supremacy, a global superpower in the making. There are maybe some crucial traditions being formed, though, which will feature in lights and glorious technicolour in British history. The tradition of individualism, of piracy, of profit and warfare, and of a partnership between state and private enterprise which harnessed the animal energies, ambitions and talents of the English who made their living by the sea. Okay, so by the death of King John in 1216, the Angevins had lost Normandy and Greater Anjou to the French crown. And in 1224, John's son, Henry III, proved himself a chip off the old block by losing control of Poitou. In the process, they lost control of one of the greatest of French port cities, La Rochelle, and only Gascony was now left in France down in the southwest, all the way across the Bay of Biscay. All of this was hugely significant. From being once landlocked essentially in the north, the French crown now had a string of coastal ports in Normandy and Poitou. Huh. Conversely, England no longer controlled both sides of the narrow seas, which is for some reason what I've started calling the English Channel. I really have no idea why. It sounds more nautical somehow. Aha, aha it is. And anyway, the English coastal ports were now much more vulnerable to French raids. So this might have been a good time to return to the Anglo-Saxon system of a national navy. But if it would have been a good idea, it was a good idea the Plantagenets were to ignore. But where there's muck, there's brass, as they say, and the situation was good for some people. In adversity is opportunity and all that sort of thing. To illustrate how English kings did react, let us turn briefly to the life of one Walter le Fleming. Walter was a merchant of Southampton, maybe born around 1200, and a man with an eye to the main chance. At the heart of England's overseas commerce were two big trades, of course, wool and wine. Until John carelessly let northern France slip out of his back pocket, the English got much of their wine from the Burgundy region, shipped down the River Seine and through Normandy. The loss of Normandy gave them a problem, and English tastes turned to wines from the Loire Valley, through Poitou and from the port of La Rochelle. And then, irritating, La Rochelle went the same way as Normandy. Walter's response was to make a deal with Henry III. Obviously, there could be no official trade with France, who was, after all, the evil enemy, but who wants to come back from work and not be able to hit the flagon? So, he managed to persuade Henry to give him a special license to trade in La Rochelle and bring out wine, salt and other merchandise. However, this was not a long-term or complete solution, and the English switched their wine-drinking allegiances to the light red wine of the Bordeaux region in Gascony instead. It's a wine traditionally called claret, or at least sometimes called claret in England, a word which comes from the French clairet, a derivative of clair, light, see-through. So I guess that's the light and clear quality of the Bordeaux wine? Sink me, I don't know, just busking. The growth in the Gascon wine trade through the 13th and 14th centuries would be a defining factor of English maritime life. By the early 14th century, over 100,000 tonnes of wine were being transported from Gascony to England every year. In 1324, it made a net contribution to the English crown of 13,000 quid's worth of customs income. The ports of Gascony were humming with English ships, especially in spring and autumn. In 1304, over 1,000 ships visited Bordeaux in 8 months. Even more important was the port of Bayonne, further south, which provided constant support and loyalty to the English crown until the disasters of 1453. And as Gascony turned its attention to producing as much wine as it could squeeze from every grape that it could eke out of the land, it then needed the food it was no longer producing, and so English ships could carry grain, fish, wool, and other commodities down to Gascony on the opening leg. A couple more things like this. Firstly, the profits to be made drew English merchants to the sea lanes like fly to a jam sandwich, all sailing from England around the Breton coast and then past the Isle of Oloron, south of Brittany. And the flood of English merchants drew Breton and French pirates like fly to a bacon sandwich, all of them aiming to make themselves some jam. No merchantman, therefore, saw himself as being part of a peaceful life. Everywhere they went, they were prepared for war, prepared for violence. This was as true of Walter le Fleming as it was for anyone. His trading cogs were also cogs of war. So, in 1229, Henry III wanted a favour in return for the La Rochelle trading licence that he'd given Walter. He needed ships for his invasion of Gascony, and Walter was on hand to provide them. From there on, developed a pure, loving and generally beautiful relationship. Walter won licences to supply the king's cellar with wine, and as long as enough of his ships could avoid the Breton pirates, his fortune was made. As his ships ploughed their way faithfully over to the Bay of Biscay, Walter spent his money as successful medieval merchants did, buying land. In this case, in Southampton, Chichester, Portsmouth and Winchester, and making generous gifts to religious houses around Southampton. He became a firm part of the local bigwiggery, no wig bigger than his. Bailiff of Southampton in 1229 and 1242, chief ossifer in 1249. He founded a family that carried on the good work of making bags of cash, including a daughter-in-law, Petronilla, who carried on the business when his son died. The Flemings were MPs and local dignitaries all the way through to the 16th century. I'm reliably informed that if you visit the good town of Southampton, you will find a statue of one of them leaning on a bridge. The Flemings never forgot that their wealth rested, yes, on their own endeavours and enterprise, but very much on partnership with the king. If he wanted them, their ships were the king's ships. For example, transporting the Bishop of Bath on a diplomatic mission in 1253, 5 years before Walter died in 1258. What's important to remember is that the line between merchants, royal navies, pirates was not just wafer thin, it was essentially non-existent. In fact, it was meaningless. Piracy was everywhere. When you set out to sail into the great blue yonder, you'd better be prepared for anything and everything, and they were. And cogs were prepared equally for war and for trade. This was helpful for English kings in that it made their policy of requisitioning warships workable because the merchantmen were also warships. Just to demonstrate how far we've come since Anglo-Saxon days, in the summer of 1338, Edward III was of course in the midst of war against Scotland and preparing to launch the Hundred Years' War, as you do. Of 361 ships in royal service, just 14 of them were king's ships. The trouble was that the whole system was inherently unstable. It fed on itself like a snake eating a tail. Merchantmen preyed on other merchantmen. Ships requisitioned one day by the king would next be murdering and sinking their allies on the next, which led to expensive disputes and even brought war. The sea was like some vast lawless world outside any jurisdiction. Indeed, in 1385, the port of Great Yarmouth was to describe itself as a real frontier town. There were a couple of attempts to impose some sort of law, though it was not systematic. And something of a Barney in 1292 provides a good example of this. In 1293, Edward I and King Philip of France were strenuously trying to avoid war, so much so that Philip in fact sent an emissary to the town of Bordeaux to announce peace and promise that any attacks on English shipping had been absolutely banned. Fat chance. The next the good people of Bordeaux knew, a private navy of Norman merchants appeared sailing up the Gironde, burning and stealing as they came. So, English merchantmen put their heads together and pooled resources, and a fleet composed of Gascons, Irish and Cinqueport ships descended in May on the Norman ports and set the record straight. Tit for tat, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, saccalard for saccalard. On the way back, the Gascons attacked La Rochelle on the way past because, you know, they were bored and they didn't like the Rochelais and idle hands and all that, you know. This was basically private war. The incident demonstrates why this was such a nightmare for kings. Because the Rochelais complained, and they complained to King Philip as Edward III's liege lord. Philip could now claim jurisdiction as feudal lord over Edward. It made him an excuse to confiscate Edward's lands of Gascony. Edward, at this point, played a tricksy legal card. He made a claim for sovereignty over the sea that would become something of a feature of the English, much to the annoyance of other nations. Edward claimed that the kings of England, time out of mind, had been in peaceable possession of the sovereign lordship of the English sea and the islands therein. For the first time, some attempt was being made to take responsibility for law and order at sea. Unfortunately, it was a dead letter. Edward was merely doing this to claim that this battle was an internal dispute for him to resolve, and no one else, that the French king had no jurisdiction here. While it was clever enough to get Edward off the hook this time, it also rather amusingly meant that every time there was any trouble, merchants all along the French and English coasts made claims for compensation from the English crown. You might note that the lawlessness at sea was not just a feature of periodically weak royal authority, as fluctuations in violence in land tended to be. This is Edward I we're talking about. This is one of England's fiercest kings. And violence wasn't restricted to a sort of national antagonism. English ships preyed on English ships, as well as French. In 1315, a Gascon merchant shipped wine to England and was set upon and robbed by a fleet from the Cinque Ports. It's chaos. It's international chaos, actually. And to illustrate the chaos, why don't we look at the life of one John Crabbe? Okay, so are you sitting comfortably? Then I shall begin. The year is 1305, and John the Warder is aboard his merchantman, the Warder Bork. John was a merchant from Dordrecht, part of the lands of the Count of Holland and Zeeland, and he's a trading man. He deals in bringing goods from Flanders, probably cloth, all the way around the coast of Brittany, down to La Rochelle. There he sells his goods and picks up wine for the return trip. His is a reasonably small ship. The Warder Bork is carrying 160 tons of wine and some other goods. Now, no doubt John was feeling relieved to have completed the first part of his journey without incident and to be setting out for home, but it would be a good long time before he'd relaxed, because he had all the perils of the northern seas to contend with. Just to the south of La Rochelle was the Isle of Oléron, a notable place for pirates. If he survived that, he had the entire Breton coast to get by, particularly to sail past the Roads of Brest. And then, of course, there were all those English pirates. He'd expect a long, hard sail. Not far away from where John anxiously scanned the horizon for unknown sails, at the skies for wind and at his crew for some signs of reassurance, was a ship commanded by a group of men who were comfortable with each other's presence. They were drawn from six towns of Flanders, and their master was a man called John Crabbe. Crabbe was a Fleming who would live in Flanders, Scotland and England in his time and jumped ship between masters more times than a dog flea. On this day he had a younger relative with him too, one Peter Crabbe, and maybe it was these sharp young eyes that spotted the sail of the Warder Bork not far out from La Rochelle, and they set off in pursuit. On the Warder Bork, John saw them coming and crammed on every inch of canvas possible, and he ran for his life. But it was no use. Crabbe's ship was larger and faster, and try as he might, John could not shake him off. The Warder Bork was duly boarded, and probably John resigned himself to his fate and didn't try to fight Crabbe off, since he and his crew were apparently kidnapped and would live to fight another day. However, the lack of bloodshed was the only positive here. Crabbe and his friends were from Flanders, and their count was the traditional enemy of the Count of Holland and Zeeland, where John was from. So, John was forced to watch while his ship was emptied of all its contents, including all those lovely tons of wine, and then his most valuable possession, his ship, was burned. We don't know exactly how much his ship would have cost, but he claimed 2,000 quid, so it would have been a very substantial sum indeed. This, then, is how John Crabbe appears in the pages of history. It is more than likely this is not his first act of piracy, and it certainly won't be his last. He let John go, and John would pursue Crabbe through the courts of King Philip of France. And actually, Philip tried pretty hard to help John, because it gave him the excuse to get involved between the Count of Flanders and the Count of Holland and Zeeland. In fact, after 4 long years, Crabbe was indeed convicted. But we're back in fat lot of use territory. Crabbe was never captured and, unsurprisingly, chose not to pay any compensation without the long arm of the law actually feeling his collar while he did it. 5 years later, Crabbe struck again and bore down on and captured a ship sailing near to Dover on the way to London. Crabbe must have been delighted with his haul. There was cloth, gold, jewels and silver. Yum, yum. Another haul worth about 2,000 quid. Less delightfully, though, the ship belonged to Alice of Hainault, Countess Marshall, daughter of the Count of Hainault and widow of Roger Bigod, the Earl of Norfolk. What I'm saying is that Alice had powerful friends, and so King Edward I pursued Crabbe for justice. justice that was, once more, never forthcoming. So in 1315, Edward II seized Flemish goods to compensate the Countess. Such arbitrary seizures were far from uncommon and gave loads of opportunity for international incidents. Once again, you can see piracy increasing political and diplomatic instability. In this case, Edward was being hard on the Count of Flanders because the Count just could not find Crabbe, for the very good reason that Crabbe was not there. Because realising that he'd stirred up a hornet's nest this time, Crabbe needed to get away from the jurisdiction of both Flanders and England, and so it was off to Scotland that he went, mindful of the less than friendly relationships between England and Scotland at the time. And he based himself now in the northeast of Scotland at Aberdeen. Flemings had been encouraged to settle in Scottish towns since the 12th century and the days of David I, and it seems that Crabbe set up a house and family there. In 1367, another John Crabbe makes his appearance in the town, and it seems likely that he's a descendant. Anyway, he very probably felt pretty safe there, confident that Robert I, Robert Bruce, would give Edward II short shrift along Bannockburn lines if he came to get him. And from Aberdeen, Crabbe was able to resume a happy, carefree life of piracy, raiding English merchants sailing out of Newcastle. All of this was chaos that kings and counts could in fact hardly complain about, since they were in every way complicit and part of the system. If they even wanted to impose order on all of this, they were utterly rotten at remaining consistent or working together with other kingdoms. Time after time, they were guilty of prioritising expediency over right, of using men like Crabbe for their own ends as they needed to. And it was this very thing that now allowed Crabbe to return home to Flanders. Because the Count of Flanders and the King of England fell out, so Count Robert no longer had any interest in pursuing Crabbe for Countess Alice's compensation on behalf of the English King. So not only could Crabbe return home to Flanders, but Count Robert actually promoted him to a position of trust on his side. Suddenly, Crabbe, with all his knowledge, was a useful, resourceful man who could help carry war against England. Crabbe was duly made Admiral of Flanders, and so this is the definitive poacher-turned-gamekeeper example. And in 1316, the new gamekeeper seized an English ship off the Downs with 788 quid worth of wine on board and then legged it back to Flanders in safety. This now became something of a cause célèbre. For 5 years, the English Chancery hammered away at the Count of Flanders for restitution. They did get an answer at one point. Count Robert sat down with his clerk one day and instructed him to write innocently that he'd love to help, but he had no idea where this John Crabbe fellow lives. Come on, he's your admiral, for crying out loud. I have visions of a Christmas panto with English lawyers pointing at Count Robert's admiral, screaming, "There he is! He's there! Right there! Behind you! There he is!" Well, the good count pretends to look wildly around him, failing to see Crabbe standing right beside him. Count Robert might have done better, actually, to work harder at it, because Crabbe was clearly freelancing on the side, and by 1315 the Great Famine was devastating Flanders and many parts of Europe, and pirates like Crabbe, of course, didn't help. In despair, a Dutch chronicler wrote, "And in addition to the harm these men wrought, Crabbe also contributed his share. He wrought great damage on the seas, showing mercy to no one. Now he appeared here, now there, now he served one person, next he turned up against him and sought the favour of another. Such is the evil of the company of robbers. They do not keep the promises they make, and are in the end themselves deceived." Crabbe's freelancing activities seem to have convinced the Count eventually that Crabbe was no good for him, and Crabbe now turned up in Scotland once more, and once again his talents were recognised and gratefully embraced by the Scots. He set up shop this time in Berwick and contributed to the defence of the town against the English. His relentless plunder of the English merchants continued. Just to reinforce that point I was making about the absence of a line between merchant and pirate, Crabbe also turned to trading, supplying and victualling the Scottish court. And in 1332 the Scots had greater need of him than ever, because Edward III decided that before he could take on France, Scotland must be neutralised. His first throw of the dice in this regard was to support the invasion of a pretender to the Scottish throne, Edward Balliol, and sponsored him by English arms. As the Scottish regent, Andrew Murray, prepared to fight Balliol on land, therefore, Crabbe was commissioned by the Scots to attack by sea, and gathering 10 ships, Crabbe appeared to have executed his part of the plan perfectly, catching English ships by surprise in the Firth of Tay. The 100% record seemed to be still on. But for once, Crabbe's luck was out. The English fought back, and by the end of the day, most of Crabbe's 10 ships were destroyed, and only with great difficulty did he manage to make it back to Berwick. And then, even worse, Crabbe joined Murray's land forces and in October 1332 met the English in battle. There he met one Walter Manny, and we know there can be only one result of an encounter with Manny. Crabbe was captured by the English he'd tormented so long and whose torture seemed to be the only constant in Crabbe's career to date. He was surely toast. The English Parliament in York was over the moon, Jim. It's a measure of Crabbe's notoriety by this stage that the Parliament troubled itself to actually petition the King to make absolutely sure that Crabbe received his due justice, accusing Crabbe of having hung numerous men by the masthead. King Edward III faithfully promised to keep the man in chains and safe for the visitation of the proper justice. But in his prison, Crabbe desperately pulled strings to escape his destiny, and he managed to persuade his capture to arrange free conduct to Edward's Michaelmas court of 1333. I ask you then to picture the scene 1 September to visualise John Crabbe standing, possibly shackled, in front of the young Edward III and his council. Surely can't have expected much. He had little to trade for his life, and Edward and his council would have known that their merchants in the north would be outraged with anything other than death for their arch enemy. But Crabbe did hold one card. Edward had recently won a great victory against the Scots at Halidon Hill. The next step was to secure the border by taking the town and castle of Berwick. Now, as we know, Crabbe was a citizen of that town and had already seen to its defence against an invading English army. He knew better than anyone how it might be taken. So, here's a thought. Why not employ me, John Crabbe, to help you, King? And let's forget all that unpleasant justice stuff. Incredible as it might seem, the King and his council bought the idea. Crabbe escaped seemingly certain destruction, and he would indeed be at the King's side as Edward took the town of Berwick that had changed hands so many times before. There was a price to pay, but it wasn't John Crabbe who paid it. When the citizens of Berwick heard that Crabbe had turned his coat to help Edward, they hunted down and dragged his son from Crabbe's house in town and slaughtered him, slaughtered the son for the sins of the father. The success at Berwick meant that Crabbe was now firmly established in Edward's regard, and really, it's got to be one of the greatest comebacks since Lazarus. Over the next few years, Crabbe is constantly in the service of the King. He retains property in Berwick, since Berwick was now, of course, an English town, and he is frequently commissioned to maintain the affected defence of the town. He worked as a merchant to supply military goods to the Crown, and appears with titles such as Royal Sergeant and Royal Yeoman that emphasise the high regard in which he was held by Edward, not to mention being made Constable of Somerton Castle for life, a nice little earner. And from 1337, Crabbe's expertise was in demand as never before, because Edward III was going to war, in fact, taking the first steps to committing his country to 113 years of the stuff. So, who else could advise better on the seaways and coasts of Flanders than John Crabbe? Crabbe was pressed into service and appears in positions alongside the Admiral and commanding groups of archers. It has to be said that in all of this, he was never in the big job again. He seems to have been regarded as a specialist and artisan, not the general. Nonetheless, in 1314 then, Edward had a big decision to make which could determine the course of the war. Philip of France had gathered a huge fleet at the port of Sluis in Flanders. Now, should the English wait and see what he did, or should they attack when they had the chance? And as the council gathered, Crabbe was brought in to provide the definitive advice, which he gave with the shaking of head and the sucking of teeth, and which Edward, being Edward, ignored and went anyway. The result was the victory at Sluis. As an aside, Sluis is interesting in that time and time again we'll see that trapping an enemy fleet in harbour was by far the best way to inflict real damage on your opponent's fleets, taking us way back to Alfred's strategy. And although the victory at Sluis was dismissed often as simply a tactical victory and that France would re-establish her navy, was hugely significant in demonstrating that England could win against the French and Edward could persevere. Anyway, Crabbe was there at Sluys despite the tooth sucking and led a squadron of ships chasing the French survivors. We have some records around this time in 1342, which give us an idea of the stock of ships from which English kings were drawing at this time. It was a survey designed to plan a series of expeditions to Brittany. And so from all around England, royal officials managed to gather 653 privately owned English ships from 80 ports, in a total fleet of 675, and those ships were manned by 10,000 mariners. It's a pretty impressive number, and of course unlikely to be the total number, though, fair dues, all of these ships would have been composed of a wide range of ship types and capacities. Anyway, Crabbe appears on the odd occasion again in the historical record, running errands to the continent or in his position as Constable of Somerton Castle, but it's now much more sparse until his death in 1352. So, what do we take away from his career, apart from the fact that after all of that he managed to die in his bed? The flexibility or inconsistency of kings like Edward rehabilitating criminals is very alien to us, and Crabbe is very much not alone in this. The use of royal pardons to forgive a stream of wrongdoing in return for a useful service, it's constant through the Middle Ages. His career also speaks to a casual internationalism in Northern Europe between England, France, Scotland, the Low Countries, and it demonstrates that even the more lowly in status could rise and succeed if they had the talent, if that's the way to describe what our hero or anti-hero has. The lawlessness of the sea and the lack of control of monarchs is also striking, and this will be a feature of our story really until gunpowder again begins to make the entry costs for privateers beyond the reach of all but the most ambitious and creates a clearer line between merchant and royal warship. There was no international law about international jurisdictions and no prospect of any at the time. There were some laws of the sea, actually, the most famous of which are the laws of Oleron, but these dictate things like onboard discipline, the rights to wages and so on, not international jurisdiction. The rules of Oleron, as they're known, were traditionally thought to be promulgated by Eleanor of Aquitaine in 1160 and adopted then by Richard I, Richard the Lionheart. But despite the fact that this is what you'll see on Wikipedia, scholars put their development much later, around 1286. They seem to have been developed by the English to regulate behaviour in the all-important sea lanes in Northern Europe, and their name of Oleron emphasises just how important La Rochelle and Oleron were to mariners, and why pirates such as John Crabbe used the seas around the island as a hunting ground. I put a copy of the Rolls of Oleron on the website. Their acceptance, of course, depended on where your court case took place, but in England they do seem to have been widely accepted as authoritative. I'm not going to lie to you, they are not the most fascinating of law codes. Fish figure quite highly, for example. You know, it's difficult to get emotional about a fish, given the lack of furriness. I appreciate this is deeply shallow of me, if you can be deeply shallow. But they do tell us something of the society on board ship at the time, the laws, that is, not the fish. So let's very quickly have a look at something of what they tell us about shipboard life in those days, just to finish off. In these early days, there's not a lot of hierarchy on board. Put out of your mind the idea of midshipmen and able seamen and captains and lieutenants and all that. That's much later. Basically, you have a bunch of seamen and a steersman who was in command of the ship. The title of steersman becomes changed to the normal usage of master, and the master was in sole command, and to a large degree, arbiter of the fate of his men. The most common deviation from this model was when there was a contingent of soldiers on board, but it seems clear that even if the commander of the soldiers was of higher rank, the master was still always in control when they were on ship. The master was expected to perform the role of judge and peacemaker among his men, but there's none of the captain as arbiter of life and death thing that you get later. It seems to be a curiously democratic environment. Not quite the right word, since democratic was a four-letter word back then, but consent from the crew was required in both business and navigation. So one punishment, for example, might be to ostracise a shipmate for a while, send them to Coventry, as it were, for which the consent of the crew was required. Of course, as Midlanders know that sending anyone to Coventry should be regarded as a prize of the highest value, but then we are strange folk. Not only was consent required from the crew, but there is a level of care and moderation built into the code. So, for example, Article 7. If it happens that sickness seizes on any one of the mariners while in the service of the ship, the master ought to set him ashore, to provide lodging and candlelight for him, and also to spare him one of the ship boys, or hire a woman to attend him, and likewise to afford him such diet as is usual in the ship. Or in Article 12, and if the master strike any of the mariners, he ought to bear with the first stroke, be it with the fist or open hand. But if the master strikes him more than one blow, the mariner may defend himself. You might think it difficult for any mariner to bring an action against his boss, but there were surviving cases where a mariner did indeed successfully bring cases against masters for breaking this rule. Finally, the laws are pretty realistic about seamen, viz. At random, Article 6. If any of the mariners hired by the master of any vessel go out of the ship without his leave and get themselves drunk, and thereby there happens some contempt to their master, debates or fighting and quarrelling amongst themselves, whereby some happen to be wounded, in this case the master shall not be obliged to get them cured, or in anything to provide for them, but may turn them and their accomplices out of the ship. As the 14th century wears on, some other roles do begin to appear a bit, so the role of constable sometimes, you know, law and order police sort of thing, master carpenters, clerks or pursers in the bigger ships, but the position of mate doesn't appear until the 15th century. Of the ordinary mariners, it's difficult to say much at all, but there are a couple of snippets. So the size of the crew seems to follow a rule of thumb of about one crew member for every 3 to 4 tons of ship, and the mariners would normally be recruited by the master, though masters of king's ships were issued a formal warrant to help them impress men. The word impressment raises images of tyrannical press gangs searching the streets of London, and that might be the case, actually. But legally, the right of impressment was seen at the time as the normal application of royal prerogative powers, you know, the right of the king to demand military service. One thing that struck me is that a seaman may be a seaman, but not the whole seaman, nothing but the seaman. I mean, by and large, seafarers would spend their working lives at sea, whether mainly in fishing, commerce, or the military, and move between all three occupations, actually. And the profession often ran in the family as well, but they were never divorced from the normal demands of life on sea. For example, we have some surviving records of one John Shipman from Brightlingsea, and it's clear that he was also expected to work in the Lord's fields, just like anybody else, to rake manure from the carts and other services. The very young recruits that are such a feature of young shipmen of later centuries seem to be quite rare, but start to appear from the 14th century, such as they appear at all. And where they are mentioned, the poor poppets are often used to work aloft, small and neat, I suppose, able to scramble up where fat podcasters fear to tread, and I suppose they make less of a dent in the decking when they fall off. I think the sound of small children falling from ships' rigging seems a suitable place to leave it for this week. Wait on at the end of the episode if you want to do our shanties for the week. For the next episode of The Sea, we will get up to the days of Henry VIII, so that this series can begin to perform its planned role of being an occasional addition to the history of England, of sea stories and fun, that sort of thing. Next week, though, we're back to Scotland and the Bruce. See you all there. Good luck, everyone, and have a great week. Now then, Shantyland. This week we're going to have a couple of capstan shanties. The capstan is also known as the windlass, the mechanism for raising the anchor or repetitive tasks, and the songs needed to have a constant rhythm, therefore. So, as the longest Johns sing these two shanties, you need to imagine them trudging round the capstan. Capstan shanties tend to have a smoother rhythm with grander verses. I'm going to give you two. The first is Randy Dandy-O, the second, a version of The Drunken Sailor, which it transpires is the only shanty I have always known, and I didn't know it was a shanty. I hope you enjoy them both.
Now we are ready to head for the horn. Way, hey, roll and go. Our boots and our clothes, boys, are all in the pond. To me, rollicking Randy Dandy-O. Heave a pull and heave away. Way, hey, roll and go. The anchor's on board and the cables all start. To me, rollicking Randy Dandy-O.
Man, the stout cap started here with a well.
Way, hey, roll and go.
Soon I'll be driving away down the hill.
To me, rollicking Randy Dandy-O. Heave a pull and heave away. Way, hey, roll and go. The anchor sailors on board and the cables all stop to be rollicking randy dandy-o. Soon we'll be warping her out through the locks. Way-hey, rolling, go where the pretty young girls all come down in flocks to be rollicking randy dandy-o. Heave a pull and heave away. Way-hey, rolling, go. Anchors on board and the cables all start to me rollicking randy dandy-o. We're outward bound for Valipo Bay. Way, hey, roll and go. Get cracking, Miller's is a hell of a way to me rollicking randy dandy-o. Heave a ball and heave away. Way, hey, roll and go. Anchors on board and the cables are stowed to me rollicking randy dandy-o. Heave a pull and heave away. Way, hey, roll and go. The anchors on board and the cables are stowed to me rollicking randy dandy-o.
From Tortuga's port we put to sea and sailed for 16 days. In the biggest storm I'd ever seen, we almost lost our way. When a call came from a deckhand, boys, I think she's going down. But don't you fear, there's enough from here to
drink until we drown. Ho! What shall we do with a drunken sailor? What shall we do with a drunken sailor? What shall we do with a drunken sailor? A lie in the morning. Hooray, and up she rises. Hooray, and up she rises.
Deckhand grabbed a barrel, broke the seal and took a swig. And soon their screams turned into songs, their panicked work turned into jigs. The first mate bellowed orders, ever trying to save their skins. Any drunken wretch the captain catch or
beat or limb from limb. Ho! What shall we do with a drunken sailor? What shall we do with a drunken sailor? What shall we do with a drunken sailor? A lie in the morning. Hooray, and up she rises. Hooray, and up she rises.
Every man continued drinking, all their duties long forgot. They were deaf to every order till they heard a pistol shot. The captain stood on forecastle, swung the cat above his head. Back to your posts, or by my ghost,
you'll wish that you were dead! Ho! What shall we do with a drunken sailor? What shall we do with a drunken sailor? What shall we do with a drunken sailor? A lie in the morning. Hooray, and up she rises. Hooray, and up she rises. She rises a lie in the morning.
Every drunk received a beating, some of the drunker managed to. The captain kept an eye until he sobered up his crew. He then retired to quarters, put the rum upon his shelf. Sat in his seat, put up his feet and
drank the rest himself. Ho! What shall we do with a drunken sailor? What shall we do with a drunken sailor? What shall we do with a drunken sailor? A lie in the morning. Hooray, and up she rises. She rises, and up she rises, a lie in the morning.
Put him in the longboat till he's sober.
Shave his belly with a rusty razor.
Roam home with the captain's daughter.